Well, we want to welcome everybody back again today. This is our last day, as everybody knows. We're going to today. We've gone through all 12 chapters of Daniel, and then today what we're going to do is go back and go through chapter 4. I think that was a request to get some more detail on chapter 4. And then if there's any additional questions anybody has on Daniel and or anything else they want to discuss, we'll see if we can pick Brother David's brain and get some of that information too. So at this point, we're going to turn the meeting over to Brother David.
Thank you. And let's see, now how do I get something from there? Oh, there we go. That's wonderful. Now, we were in Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12. Oh, that'll jump quick. Oh, yeah, that's right. And there's a couple of things we might just look at that we didn't mention yesterday in Daniel 12. And then we're going to jump to Daniel 4, as Brother Bill mentioned. But in Daniel chapter 11, you know, we went through that yesterday in great detail, right? Would you agree with that? I think everybody would agree. That was detailed. That's why frequently the brethren don't go into it, because it's so much detail. Now, let's see. I guess I should have a list of those rulers again, shouldn't I? Yeah, I guess I'll have to get that from here. Yeah. There we go. Here's one. And we're just going to review just a few minutes, just review what we had yesterday. And then we're going to explain two reasons why we're impelled in this direction. There were two famous marriage alliances. And, you know, if you want to kind of keep this straight in your mind, remember that there are six generations of rulers in Egypt, six generations of rulers in Syria, in the Seleucid Empire. And that's all you've got. And then after that, from Antiochus Epiphanes, it jumps to Rome and then Papal Rome. So when you think about just six and six, it's pretty straightforward. And remember, this Ptolemy Philadelphus, what's he famous for? In our frame of reference, what's he famous for? Septuagint translation of the Bible, yeah. When I can link these people into something that I can relate to, it helps me remember them better. Long reign, 38 years, and before he died, he married off his daughter to this gentleman, Antiochus Theus, after two wars had gone through. They had a marriage alliance. So I remember that marriage alliance in Daniel, the 11th chapter. And turn there quick. That would be verse 6, Daniel 11, verse 6. And that is so easy. Daniel 11, verse 6 obviously talks about a marriage alliance. The end of years they shall join themselves together. The king's daughter of the north shall come to the king of the south, rather, shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now, that's telling you, it's a marriage alliance, there's no question. So that's so easy to remember. I say, well, okay, verse 6 is that marriage alliance. Well, that's one link that I can make easily to this passage. And another marriage alliance is in verse 17. He shall set his face to enter with the strength of the whole kingdom, upright ones with him, then thus shall he do. He shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she won't stand on the side of her father. She'll join the side of her husband. Well, that's Antiochus Magnus giving his daughter to the young Ptolemy Epiphanes. And that's the second marriage alliance. And if you just remember those two marriage alliances, that's it. Just those two. And a list of six here and six here. And you've got two links that kind of link right to the prophecy, and you can just go backward and forward from those two links. You know, that's simple enough for me to kind of remember. And that's the way I do remember it. I remember those two marriage alliances. They're the only two marriage alliances you got in the history here, and it kind of gives you a backbone. You can fill in things before and after that. Now, yesterday we looked at the interpretation that came from Uriah Smith. or the Adventist. And that has worked its way into our thinking as well. But I want to give two reasons why I think that doesn't quite match. Now, I gave one of those yesterday. One of those is in, and just if you remember these two things, that might be helped as well. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. And Uriah Smith approaches that that's Augustus Caesar. He did raise taxes, so maybe that's right. But remember, the problem is, in this text, he is destroyed. He didn't die peacefully, he's destroyed. Whereas Augustus died peacefully in his sleep. Maybe somebody said yesterday, maybe the only Roman emperor that ever did, but he did. Excuse me. So I think that's a little imprecision with the Uriah Smith approach. I understand the attraction why he did it. He's trying to jump big segments to get to where we need to go, and that is the kingdom by chapter 12. But the other is verse 25, and I didn't mention this yesterday. Now, this might not seem as strong, but I still think it's a rough spot with that approach. Verse 25, does anybody know, in verse 25, halfway through, when it says, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to a battle with a great mighty army, but he shall not stand. Anybody know who that king is in the Uriah Smith approach? Now, I'm asking for an opinion that I don't even agree with, you see, but I just want to... Anybody know who that's supposed
to be?
No, not yet. Not yet. No, beyond that, beyond Julius Caesar.
That wouldn't be Zenobia, would it?
It would be Zenobia. Now, Zenobia was a man or a woman?
A woman.
So we got masculine pronouns here for a feminine person. That's a rough spot. However, you might say, well, okay, but as king, you know, king is a masculine word, and so that's the way it is. Well, do they ever use feminine pronouns in the entire passage when a woman is being spoken about? Do they ever? Well, where? Give me an example.
Well, we just read the one of the two marriage alliances.
There you go. That's right. And she. So when it's a woman, it says she. When it's a man, it says he. Now, you might be able to explain your way out of that, but it's an imprecision. And so those are two things that I just look at and say, even historically, they don't quite fit. So I think that helps sway the issue. But, of course, the real thing that really sways the issue is that when you get down to verse 31, Jesus says, that is pagan Rome. All the Jews say it's Antiochus Epiphanes. And all we say is it's papacy. And the answer is, which is right? The answer is all of the above. You know, and I think it's just a simple answer. And beyond all that, by the time you get to chapter 12, you've got life. And Paul quotes that, I think, is referring to that in Ephesians 5:14. And that's so specific that it refers to the life at the first advent. We all think it is resurrection of the second advent. I think we're right. And so that shows multiple threads of thought that bring you to different points in chapter 12. Jeff? Oh, what were you going to say? Oh, I'm sorry. I should have... What would you have said?
In verse 24... When it says there's a time of tranquility.
Yes.
That's not on. In verse 24, where it says there's a time of tranquility, one way that they're jumping forward in great leaps of time is they're making that word time a time like in the rest of Daniel. So they're making that 360 years. So they're jumping forward a great amount of time.
Interesting. Oh, even for a time. Oh, I see, at the end of the verse. Okay. Well, you know, you try all the options, right? You see what will fit. But I feel more and more comfortable that we're on the right track here. We're always on the right track to come to the second advent by Daniel 12:1. And I think we have a credible way now of doing it. Yes?
So do you think that all of the really intense detail of these Grecian kings in Daniel 11 is mainly because of a Jewish audience earlier, or do you think that there's details that are important prophetically to us as well?
That's a good question, and I still don't know how to resolve that, because I don't know of any other way to apply the verses up through verse 31. And because they are so detailed and accurate in the other way, I'm inclined to say that's the meaning, period. And that branching off from verse 31, then we have three trains of thought. And 31, as you all know, Daniel 12 points back to and says, that's the critical verse. Jesus points back to and says, that's the critical verse. And Revelation points back to and says, that's the critical verse. So it's almost as though everybody's pointing back to 11:31 and saying that's where things change. Go ahead.
I just had a brainstorm. Is it possible maybe that in the future, when the Jews do recognize the Lord, they will find more prophetic meaning in Daniel than they currently do? Because right now, it's any studied Jewish person is going to say that this, exactly the way you described it, it goes right up to Antiochus Epiphanes.
Yes.
They're in very good agreement on that.
Yes, that's true. Well, my opinion is, as soon as they recognize Jesus as Messiah, then they'll realize, well, then Messiah said that there's something more than Antiochus, and therefore there must be another thread of thought. I don't think they'll say, oh, well, then we were wrong. I think they'll say, oh, then there was something better, something new, something additional that we didn't see. So I think they will. Now, if somebody is very clever and go through those first 31 verses and show me a parallel, I'd love to see it. But I'm dubious, to be frank. I'm dubious about that. Brother Randy.
Perhaps. Is there a reference to... is there a reference to the image of jealousy that was put by the Romans in Jerusalem? Does this have any,
you know, I'm listening to your comment, and you're asking about this image of jealousy. Is that something that comes from Ezekiel? Well, I'm trying to remember where that expression comes from.
I think it's a reference in the Gospels.
In the Gospels?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I'm hesitant to comment on that because I think I have to remember where it was. But it is true that in Matthew 24, that when the Roman legions were to come in, they would have with them the standards that reflect their gods, and this would be an abomination in the holy city of Jerusalem. Yeah. Okay, then, Stefan.
That's found in two places in Ezekiel, 8:3 and 8:5.
Mm-hmm. What is that? Who got you?
Yeah, okay. Ezekiel 8:3, and he put forth the form of a hand, and took me by a lock of mine head. The Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven, and brought me in the vision of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looked toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoked to jealousy.
Okay, so that's way back in Ezekiel's day, so, and idolatry, that's what it was, idolatry. But it is true that you have the idolatry Jesus refers to coming up in Matthew 24, so you can link that term to it, there's no problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Stefan,
yeah.
Could I have a glass of water?
Sure.
I forgot to get it. Oh, well, thank you. I'm all set to fly now. So let's fly through this. Okay, now we're going to, I want to get to Daniel 4, so let's turn right there to Daniel, the fourth chapter. And I guess I punch this. Yeah, there we go. And Daniel 4 is that dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, we treated Daniel 4 in our very first night somewhat, but it was very brief, just as an overview. And Daniel 4 is about this dream that Nebuchadnezzar, I think you just have one slide about Daniel 4. And the whole thing is there. There's a tree in the background. There's Nebuchadnezzar there roaming the beast as an earth, the earth as a beast. And I think you all know that the seven times that passed over him are a picture of the seven times of the Gentiles that take you to 1914. And I just want to go through a few details here. Let's see. Let's start with verse 10. In fact, maybe verse 9. Oh, thank you so much. Start with verse 9 and read 9 and 10, and then we'll get into it a little further. Lizette, could you start for us in Daniel 4, 9 and 10? This is where we're going to learn the dream that Nebuchadnezzar is going to recite.
I said, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and no mystery is too difficult for you. Here is my dream. Interpret it for me. These are the visions I saw while lying in my bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous.
Okay. Now, who is Belteshazzar, Lizette? Chief of the magicians. Do we know him by another name, a shorter name that's more familiar to us?
Daniel.
Daniel, yeah. So that kind of confused me if I didn't know that was the same guy. That's Daniel. That's his Babylonian name. You remember the last king that was killed when Babylon fell? What was his name? Belteshazzar. You know, it's Babylonian. That's the point. So he saw. Now this is a case where Nebuchadnezzar is going to explain the dream that he had. Now remember, in chapter 2, he didn't. Now but in chapter 4, he says, I know what it was. I just explain it to me. He's got confidence in Daniel by this time. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. Lizette, why don't you continue on with verse 12?
Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it the beasts of the field found shelter, and the birds of the air lived in its branches. From it every creature was fed.
Oh, I keep on going.
In the visions I saw while lying in my bed, I looked, and there before me was a messenger, a holy one, coming down from heaven.
Okay, now this is interesting. The King James, it says, a watcher and a holy one. What is this? Who do you think this is? I don't even need a name, but what would we call this?
An angel,
that's right. And it's interesting to me that they call these watchers. It's like they're up there seeing everything that goes on. You know, it's kind of their old way of expressing it. Go ahead, Lizette.
He called in a loud voice, "Cut down the tree and trim off its branches. Strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its root bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field."
Okay, now we're going to stop there, because that's the first half of the dream. Now, you know it's going to turn into a beast next, but right now we've just got a tree. The tree is cut down, and what is done with the stump of the tree? Lizette, do you remember?
It's left there.
The stump is left there. It's not dug up or plowed under or done anything like it. Just left there. It's almost, in a way, kind of protected. Something is put around it. Gracie, what was that?
A band?
Bands, plural. Well,
iron and bronze,
or brass in some versions, whatever difference is. So you got brass and iron bands put around it. Now, I think I can erase this. This is a discussion last night. And we're going to look and see those iron and brass bands in a few places in Scripture. They kind of give us a clue what's going to go on. But it's as though those bands of iron and brass are going to protect the stump for a later time when it will sprout and grow again. And that's the point here, is that this tree is cut down, this dominion is cut down only for time. Now, how many times is this tree going? It will pass over this tree once it's cut down? Seven, Jackie says, seven times. And I'm going to just make a note of that. This is not the good one. Let's see. Seven times. Now, I want to know how many times that's going to be said in the context of this narrative. We're going to take a note of that as we go through. But literally, what happened to Nebuchadnezzar himself that would show that he was some hope for a later time? Randy, what was the story here in this fourth chapter? What if that's Nebuchadnezzar himself and he ranged his beast for a while, what finally happened to him?
He was restored?
He emerged
out of that condition.
Okay, and I think that's where the bands of iron and brass had kind of preserved that kingdom for a while, and then it would sprout again. That's the point I wanted to get at.
Yes.
So the bands of iron and brass, if they're broken later, that means whatever is referred to by this tree is going to sprout again. Now, let me ask you, we know that this whole thing has to do with Nebuchadnezzar directly because it says so. And seven times you're going to pass over him. I don't know how long each one of those times was. Sometimes you say maybe it was a year. That would mean you have to locate 7 years in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar when he was insane. And that's hard to do. However, it could be 7 months. It could be seven seasons. We really don't know, but I'm just going to say seven times over Nebuchadnezzar. Says it happened, we all believe it did. So I'm going to say that refers to Nebuchadnezzar. But are there any other meanings to this tree kingdom that was cut down, other than just Nebuchadnezzar himself? Dave? Or Cheryl, you got your hand up.
Just on the seven times, it had to have been long enough for, for his hair to have grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws.
Okay.
So that would be a longer period of time, I would think, than just 7 months.
Okay. All right. So it's got to be a longer time, maybe seven seasons. You know, who knows? Okay. So is there any other meaning other? Did you have a comment on this, Stefan?
Could it be a kingdom?
It's a kingdom. A tree represents a kingdom, right? That's true. So what other kingdom could be referred to other than just simply Nebuchadnezzar himself? Is there a deeper meaning to this passage? Jeff?
Babylon would be one.
Babylon, okay. Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon are kind of tight.
You got 70 years, so it's a decimal equivalent of seven.
Okay, okay. Now, when you say that Babylon, what kingdom was it that Babylon conquered? I mean, the tree is cut down. This is a kingdom that's abandoned.
Okay, Assyria.
Assyria was, okay, that's good. But during the seven... There you go. Thank you. Thank you. I'll keep asking for another answer until I get what I want. Okay. So that's the kingdom of Israel. And Israel was to be subordinate to Babylon during their reign of power. And how many years was Babylon allotted power? 70 years. So we have seven times. In this case, would be seven decades. Now, is there another scope of the seven times that also applies to Israel on a bigger time scale? Yes, Jeff?
I think if you compare it to Leviticus chapter 26,
okay,
it helps identify because you have seven times also there.
Okay.
It's seven times of punishment for Israel.
Yeah.
And you also have the brass and the iron mentioned as well.
Okay.
It shows a parallel between the two chapters.
Okay. Now, and we're going to go there because you find that for me, Leviticus 26. But
19 and
20. What's that?
26, 19, and 20.
Okay, they're very good. So we'll go right there. But I want you to mention, in that reference, what is each one of these times that seven times pass over?
In Leviticus?
Well, with reference to the longer period of Israel's oppression.
Well, if it's like the 3.5 times,
yeah,
then it would be the 360.
360. The times 360. So if we take that seven times, also for Israel... That would be, this one would be 70 years, right? Seven decades. This, I don't know what it is. I'm going to say seven seasons. That's all I'm going to say. If somebody can show me 7 years in Nebuchadnezzar's history, I would use that. But I don't know if we can. But this, I'm going to put seven times, how many? 7 times 360. That would be 2,520. Seven times 360. That's good. Now, there's one more level of this that is sometimes discussed. You'll see it in Volume 2. Instead of just Israel or just Nebuchadnezzar, he says this kingdom can be even a bigger kingdom than that. Yes. Cheryl.
He uses the 7,000 years for the world.
Okay, in that case, what is the tree that's cut down that will later be restored? What kingdom was cut down that will later be restored?
The one that was in the Garden of Eden.
That's it. The perfect kingdom that God gave to Adam and Eve. Okay, so that's seven times to man, I'll say. And that would be 7,000. Seven times 1,000. Here's 7 times 10. And this is 7, whatever it was. So each one of them is 7 times, but there's 4 different scales on which these can apply. Now, let me ask you this question. We haven't gone through the 4th chapter yet in great detail, but flip through, just kind of scan through it and tell me what scriptures tell us in Daniel chapter 4 that there would be 7 times to pass over Nebuchadnezzar or in this image of this dream. And we found one of those. That was in which verse?
23.
What? Now we didn't get as far as 23. 16. 16?
Yeah.
Is that the first time that seven times passed over it? Maybe that's the first time. Maybe we didn't read that far, did we? So I just assumed. Okay, well, so I'm going to put down here verse 16. What, as somebody said, verse 23 has seven times? 23? How much? 23, 25, 32. You're telling me that the expression seven times appears four times in this chapter? Four times, what you're telling me. Okay, and there's four different possibilities for interpreting it. Well, I just put that in the back of my mind. Maybe it's just coincidence of one out of four, you know, could be, could not be, you know. But now, Jeff, you said something about Leviticus 26.
Leviticus 26 also mentions four times.
Four times? Okay, well, tell me those verses. Leviticus
21,
now, this is in Daniel 4, and this is in Leviticus 26.
Yeah.
Now, give me those verses again.
18.
Uh-huh.
21.
24 and 28. So you're saying in that whole chapter it says it four times. Okay. And here it says it four times. And there's four applications. Oh, now, I like this. Now, I didn't think of this myself. I remember a talk by Stuart Sowers. You remember Stuart Sowers? He was, when I was a boy, he was an elder in our class. I loved his talks, just as a boy. They're always so clear. But I didn't hear this talk in San Diego. I heard it later in Chicago. I happened to be there on a Sunday when he was speaking. And he made the point that there's four times it mentions it here, four times it mentions it here. He didn't tell me about this four times. But he says that kind of links the two passages as more than coincidental. They're intended to be linked together. And I thought, yeah, that's a nice link. And then later when we saw that there are four different applications to it, I thought, well, you know, that's interesting. Now in my mind, I remember those four visions of Daniel, and I remember the four venues of Revelation. I don't know if I can tie those in, but I just keep those in the back of my mind. But here, these four all seem to be cohesive. Did you have a comment?
I did.
Go ahead.
I'm also saying Leviticus 14 has it mentioned four times.
Say that again.
Leviticus 14 mentions it four times.
Okay, now I am completely surprised by that. Leviticus 14 is the healing of the leper, mm-hmm. Right?
Yep. You want the verses?
No, because I got to absorb this. Thank you. That's interesting to me. You know what I do when I hear a new thought? I put it down in green up here.
That's 16:27.
Leviticus, right? Leviticus,
yeah.
14.
7, 16.
Okay, 7, 16.
27 and 51.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to write that down. I don't know how to connect that. I don't know. But I'm going to look at that. Thank you. That's very interesting. Now, let's go back to Leviticus 26. And, Jeff, you said you found a particular verse that talked about iron and brass?
Yeah.
Which verse is that? 18? This one here? Which verse did you say?
I think it was
Okay.
That talks about iron and brass.
Yes.
Along with seven times. I think it was iron and bronze.
Okay. Leviticus 26.
19.
Let's look at 18 and 19. Let's take those together. 18 and 19. Jeff, would you read those two?
If also after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. I will also break down your pride of power. I will make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze.
Okay, so there you have the same two elements of bronze and iron. I guess I'll put them over here. Bronze and iron. So I don't think it's coincidental that against Israel are the same two elements. Now, when we get to the image, when we've already passed by the image in chapter 2, do we have any bronze and iron in the image? We do. Well, where are the bronze and iron located in the image? Which parts?
Loins and legs.
Loins and legs. Now, which were the two most oppressive governments upon Israel? Well, Grecia is where, you know, in the four horns, you had Antioch Epiphanes. That's got to be very difficult. But the breaker of Israel was Rome. So these are the two strongest governments of all. Now, Medo-Persia was kind of favorable to them. Babylon, well, Babylon did break their nation. They didn't have to if they just submitted. But then Nebuchadnezzar did praise the God of heaven, and Cyrus honored the God of heaven. So, but these were probably the two most difficult periods of time for them. So I find the brass and the iron as kind of emblematic of the hard rule that the Gentiles would exercise over Israel because of their disobedience. That's a good way to summarize it, just the brass and iron. So now we're going to, in Leviticus 26, there is a small problem with this matter of seven times. What is the Hebrew word for the word times in Daniel? Does anybody happen to remember what the Hebrew word? Yes, Joyce?
I don't remember, but I was looking it up earlier, and it's a period. It's an imprecise period. It does not have to mean year.
Okay. Idan. Iddan, something like that. Okay. Now, that's good. Now, what is the Hebrew word in Leviticus 26 that is rendered times?
I think there is one.
That's the right answer. There isn't one. So sometimes people say, hey, wait a minute, you can't make that times. It's not the same word. In fact, it's no word. It's implied. That's why some translations say seven strokes, seven blows, seven something. But it's seven that's coming against you. Now, when Joyce said that this word, Idan, doesn't have to mean a year, well, then Nebuchadnezzar could be seven seasons, seven periods of time. Could be seven anything. Except, as Sherelle says, it's got to be long enough to grow your hair and your nails. But that means that in Leviticus, I think also we have the flexibility that seven something of punishment is going to come, seven periods of time is reasonable and feasible. The fact that it doesn't have to be a single year and then take 360, you know, number of days in a year or something like that, that allows the flexibility for these various applications. It could be seven millenniums, it could be seven prophetic times, seven decades, or seven seasons. All of them are possible. Doesn't prove any one of them, but all of them are feasible. That's the point. Now, we happen to know that at least in some cases, in Daniel, this word Idan, times, does refer to a prophetic year. How do we know that? Well, because we already saw that in Daniel, the seventh chapter, you have time, times, and a half. Is that right? I remember that from Daniel chapter 7. Does that appear anywhere else in Daniel? Where? 12, not in Daniel.
Okay.
Where else in Daniel does the time, times, and a half appear? 12. Chapter 7. Chapter 12. That's good. We got them both. We got it twice there.
Huh? 12, verse 7.
12, verse 7. Was it? Okay. Chapter 7 and also 12, verse 7. Okay, very good. So we've got there time, times, and a half. And when you go to Revelation, then it says, at least once or twice, that's also 42 months. So that proves that these are 3.5 years, which is 42 months. And then we've got 1260 days and all that. So Idan certainly does mean a period of 360. It can mean that. It is applied that way in Daniel at least twice. So we're safe that it can mean that, but Joyce has given us the flexibility that it can mean broader. And I think that's true. So now let's look and see with Israel. After the 70 years, who released them from this bondage of the 70 years of Babylonian authority?
Cyrus.
Did Cyrus ever release them from bands of iron and brass?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You say yes. Prove it to me. Where?
It's in Isaiah. I can't quote it to you, but it breaks the gates of iron and brass that protected Babylon.
Okay, so let's go there, and let's look at Isaiah 45. Verse 2, is it? Okay, thank you. Now, we've referred already in our lessons from time to time to Cyrus as a picture of Jesus, because Cyrus is the Lord's anointed to help rescue Israel. And this is the passage. I don't know if we ever turned to it and read it, but this is it. Psalm 45, 1.
Isaiah 45.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Always understand what I mean, not what I say. Okay. Isaiah 45, 1 and 2. Thank you. Ben, do you have to have that in front of you?
Isaiah 45, 1 and 2. This is what the Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I take hold of to subdue nations before him, and to strip kings of their armor, to open doors before him, so that gates will not be shut. I will go before you, and I will level the mountains. I will break down the gates of bronze and cut through the bars of iron.
Okay, so he does that. Now, literally, we mentioned that Babylon, where Israel was captive, was laid on the river Euphrates. And the river Euphrates went right through the city, and you had gates of brass that prevented people getting in there, like a foreign army, and that's why they diverted the river and then went right under them. But I think the gates of brass, and here it mentions bars of iron, are emblematic of the strong strength of the Babylonian Empire that Cyrus would break apart and let Israel go free. So when that tree had brass and iron put around the stump of it, see, there's the iron, and I don't know what to do for brass. Yeah, yellow. Yeah. Well, here's, I don't know. That's yellow. So when they had these bands put around the stump of it and Cyrus breaks that, what does that suggest? This tree is going to start sprouting again. And it began to sprout again when Israel came back to their land after the 70 years. Cyrus let them go free, and then they started their altar and then their temple and finally the walls of the city. And, you know, they got back to what they had been before Nebuchadnezzar destroyed them. So that's all very fitting for the end of the 70 years when Cyrus broke those bands and let them go. But when Cyrus broke the bands, they weren't immediately back with all their glory. It just didn't happen so quick. It was a long process. Now, I think that when you come down to the 2520, now you have Cyrus in the bigger picture. Who is Cyrus a picture of? Jesus. And what Jesus does for them after the seven times of Gentile power is he breaks those bands of iron and brass. Now, we go to this image. He's going to break those bands of iron and brass and let Israel go free after 1914. That is consistent with the thought that this stone strikes the image in 1914, and from thereafter, not immediately, but a process, begins the restoration of Israel. Now, of course, they went back to the land starting in 1878, but nationally they were part of the Ottoman Empire, and there was no hope, no prospect for independence. Not until World War I struck, and then England says, we now are in control, and we favor making Palestine a national homeland for the Jewish people. So thereafter, gradually, it began to sprout. So I think it's been sprouting since 1914. Okay, any comments or input, Jeff?
Do you find seven times anywhere else in Scripture? Daniel chapter 5 is an
example. Well, you got it here. Still got to think that through. This is the healing of the leper, right?
Yeah.
And so I have thought of that as after 7,000 years, the humanity is cleansed. You know, and maybe if we want to take it to the church, after seven periods of the church is exalted in glory and without sin anymore. Something like that. I never thought about, you know, applying that to here. I got to think that through. The fact that it's four times and I'm making a point of four times here, is something for me to think about. That's all I can say. Yeah, thanks a lot, Stefan. But, you know, that's the value of this feedback. And, yeah, Jeff.
I have just one other passage.
Yeah. Oh, okay, go ahead.
And that's one that Jim Parkinson's added as a footnote from an article I wrote for Beauties of the Truth.
Okay.
Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 9.
Habakkuk?
Habakkuk 3, verse 9.
Okay.
He was also during the Babylonian period.
Yeah.
And there's a problem with this verse in Hebrew. It could be translated 20 different ways.
Okay.
So if you look at it in all these different translations, you'll hear multiple ways it could be translated, like the oaths unto the tribes, the rods of chastisement or rods of punishment, or you uncovered your bow. I mean, the words are very, very difficult.
I'm starting to remember your article now.
In one of these commentaries I have here, Cook's commentary, he suggests the translation could be sevens of chastisements are the decree.
Uh-huh.
Or seven times of chastisements. Instead of rods, seven. Sevens, and that's the word for oaths. And so the idea, and they say, well, that doesn't make any sense. We don't see that, how that could fit with anything else in Scripture. But it fits very well with Habakkuk being a contemporary of Daniel. Here you got seven times again, and it takes you to the end. And chapter 3 is about the final judgment after the Gentile times are complete.
Excellent, excellent.
And that's
all
released.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, I remember your article, and I remember thinking, boy, there's something interesting here, but I didn't absorb it all. So I'm glad for this mention of it. Okay, that would be very cooperative, you know, at very same time period. Okay, now I want to look for another iron and Dave, go ahead.
Deuteronomy 28.
Okay, let's look at that. That's very compatible. Deuteronomy 28, which verse?
28,
23. Let's see, I'll put it down here. Deuteronomy 28, 23. Okay, go ahead.
Deuteronomy 28, 23 says, and thy heaven that is over thy head shall be brass, and the earth that is under thee shall be iron.
Okay, all right. Now, the heaven and the earth, brass, you know, you're not going to be very productive here. There's no rain, and you can hardly break up the ground. It's just the oppressive elements that are going to be not allowing you to prosper as a national entity. So I think that's saying the same thing as the Leviticus 26:8-19, yeah, and yeah, I think that's basically two testimonies of the same thing. That's a very good connection. Now I want to go to one more place, and that's in the book of Job. This is a little more remote, maybe, but I got this from Brother Carl in his lesson on Job once. Let's see, where is this? 40:18. Let's go to Job 40:18. Yeah, that's it. Who can find that for us? Stefan, you got it right there?
His bones are as strong as pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron.
Now, who is this talking about in Job chapter 40? In my King James, I have a word for it.
Behemoth,
that's right. Now, what is behemoth? Well, it's I could ask you also, there's another creature that's talked about that's very bad, and it's Leviathan. And you say, well, it's Leviathan. Well, different people think different animals. Leviathan is sometimes rendered to be a crocodile. But maybe both of them are semi-mythical creatures that are just, you know, like a dragon or a monster or something. But behemoth, if anything, is like a huge elephant. What do you got?
Hippo.
Okay. Now, both of those are just large, ponderous, dominant animals, and you can hardly withstand them. You know, they wanted to go somewhere, you couldn't really restrain them. And Brother Carl said that these two creatures represent the beast, Behemoth, and the dragon, Leviathan. Now, I think we can make a good case for Leviathan as the dragon, because Isaiah 27:1 says, in that day the Lord shall slay Leviathan, even the dragon that's in the midst of the sea. You put the two words together. And Behemoth, like that great beast of Daniel chapter 7, that incredible beast, that seems a reasonable connection. And Behemoth has bones like iron. What did the word say? What did the scripture say?
Limbs like bars of iron.
Say again.
Bones like tubes of bronze and limbs like bars of iron.
Bones like bronze and arms like iron. Okay, so you've got in this beast iron and brass. And I think that reminds us of the great beast Rome that's going to be oppressing the people of Israel. It's kind of like the image. You've got the two here, and now in this beast, Leviathan, Behemoth, you've got the same picture. Now, Carl suggested that the book of Job is all about the tribulations of Job, all about the tribulations of God's people Israel. And that, you know, Job lost all of his possessions, he lost his family and all that, but he's restored double at the end, just about everything. And this shows how Israel and the kingdom is going to have a double measure of what they had before. It's going to be wonderfully blessed. Everything's going to turn out well for them. And I think when I go through the book of Job, that makes a great deal of sense. So I think here, these two creatures talk about those entities that have kind of overwhelmed the nation of Israel. So I link in this iron and brass the same way. There's one more passage, and that's in the book of Psalms, Psalms 107. That sounds about right. Now, in Psalm, we have a repetitive, what shall I call it? A repetitive refrain that keeps coming up in this chapter. It's all about the loving kindness of God. Now, maybe somebody could read verse 8 for us. Verse 8, Psalms 107, verse 8. Odile, could you do that for us? You have that? This is Psalms 107, verse 8.
Psalm 107, verse 8. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love. Is that right?
That's, you know, it's different than mine, but it sounds about right.
Okay. For his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men.
Okay.
Was that?
And now, would you read verse 15 as well?
Yep. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love, for his wonderful deeds of men.
And verse 21.
21. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men.
And verse 31.
31. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men.
Okay, you see that repeated refrain? I was a little boring to go through, but, you know, it makes the point. It's over and over and over. And that divides the psalm into these four pieces. That's a refrain that closes out four segments of the psalm. And the first segment, I will suggest, all these four identify four classes in the divine plan of the ages that can give thanks to God because of his loving kindness that's so great. Now, again, this isn't, you know, dependent with me. I heard a talk on this by, I think it was Brother Edward Lorenz years ago. I always enjoyed Brother Lorenz's talks. I remember when I was just a boy. He was in L.A., I was in San Diego, and I thought, oh, I wish I was in L.A., I could hear him more. I always enjoyed his talks. I even remember his Sunday schools. I even remember certain things he said in the Sunday schools that I remember. This is a talk he gave. Now, I have a little different twist on some of the classes, but it's his same basic breakdown of four. And, of course, it's in the reprints somewhere, too. The first class, everybody seems to agree, is the church. That's the first several verses up until verse 8. It says, verse 2, let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he hath redeemed from the hand of the enemy, and gathered them out of the lands from the east and the west and the north and the south. They wandered in a solitary wilderness in a solitary way. They found no city to dwell in. Then they cried to the Lord. He delivered them. They got a city of habitation. I think that's the New Jerusalem. And it reminds me of what Jesus said. Many shall come from the east and the west and the north and the south and sit down in the kingdom of heaven. Of course, you scribes, Pharisees, are going to be cast out. But I think that's the church that's going to come in from the Gentile world and be part of God's elect. So now we go to part two, and that starts with verse 10. And that, I think, refers to Israel. So that we're going to focus on. And then the next one after that, I think, fools that abhor meat. I think that's a great company. And the next one's the world of mankind. But we're just going to focus on the second one. We're going to look at that because I think it's Israel. Verse 10. And Odalea, you're right there. So let's read verse 10. And verse 10 through 12.
Some sat in darkness and the deepest gloom. Prisoners suffered in iron chains, for they had rebelled against the words of God and despised the counsel of the Most High. So he subjected them to bitter labor. They stumbled, and there was no one to help.
Okay, now you notice we got part of this abound in affliction and iron. And I think that that's kind of tying into our iron here. We'll see it even more in just a moment. But, you know, I like the way you read it with a little passion, you know, a little emphasis. They, what's that?
She's,
oh, yeah, okay. Well, in verse 11, in my version, They condemned the counsel of the Most High, so he brought them down with labor and brought them low. That's what Israel did. They just rejected the counsel of God, and he brought them down. Now, verse 13 and 14.
Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he saved them from their distress. He brought them out of the darkness and the deepest gloom and broke away their chains.
Broke away their chains. Now, mine says bands, and I like that because there's bands here. But either way, it's metallic, you know, restraint. And now comes this refrain in verse 15 that you read before. And after that refrain, always comes one more verse that kind of summarizes what God did for them. That's verse 16. Let's read that. Just verse 16.
For he breaks down the gates of bronze and cuts through bars of iron.
There you go. There's the gates of brass and the bars of iron. That's what he does for Israel. And I think that's what he does for Israel in 1914. Now, you can say maybe he does that also under Cyrus. That's good. But in the big way, that's what he has done for Israel. He's broken those restraints of national authority over them, and they've gradually sprouted. And in 1948, they became a kingdom again, a tree again, after seven times of Gentile authority. I think this is really a good connection back to Daniel, the fourth chapter, these two bands of iron and brass. Okay, any comments, any discussion here? Joyce, looks like you have a thought.
Too many to put into one thought.
Okay, we'll have
too many thoughts to put into
one thought. Okay. All right. Well, she's a very thoughtful person. Yeah. Okay. Well, if there's nothing more, then well, let's see. We should deal with this 7,000 year period as well. Now that's in volume two. See, volume two, he talks about the fact that Adam's creation, Adam's dominion was cut down, and it would finally be restored at the end of 7,000 years. And that's, again, a seven times period. So I think we've got four levels of meaning here, and the four repetitions all perhaps serve to give that point. Yes?
Is there anything you see in the, 34 years from 14 to 48, in which, you know, they became a nation again? Of course, they were still oppressed after 1914.
Yes, they had a lot of problems after that. But they had somewhere to go. They had at least the Balfour Declaration in 1917 that officially said Her Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of Israel as the national homeland for the Jewish people. And even though they didn't get everything, they got enough to have a national homeland. Paul, did you have more to say? Okay, Jackie?
And one of the scriptures not only said that they did not obey God, but they disrespected him. Well, even if you apply that to the time between 1914, instead of going back to their homeland, they settled into Germany and Europe. They got real comfortable, and they really shouldn't have done that, settled down in those lands. They should have, if they really knew what the Bible said, they would have started going back to Jerusalem at that time, but they didn't. So they were disrespectful of the fact that he had let them go.
Yeah.
And so they had some trouble.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Now, by the way, it reminds me of when Israel's coming back to their land, and England has a protectorate over Palestine after World War I. What was England's original intent to give Israel a homeland? It was quite big, and I can't draw it exactly because I don't remember exactly, but it was quite big. I think it covered all of that area, certainly. And then over here, you had another country for the Arabs. But all of this land over here was going to be part of the land assigned to the Jewish people. And it's only because the Arabs created such a ruckus and such a stink that England finally said, okay, well, we'll have this partition, you know, and they created the state of Jordan and gave them some Palestinian land. That's why today you say, yeah, there is a Palestinian state. There's already exists one. It's this country of Jordan. And they've got this land today. Jordan does. It's supposed to be the land of Israel. Now, here's the point I want to make as it relates to the book of Daniel. This came in part of my thinking about Daniel 11th chapter, whether that's Napoleon or the British Empire. Jeff, you were talking about that yesterday. Well, remember the three areas that escaped the hand of this king that goes up through Palestine. What are those three areas? Edom, Ammon, and Moab. And they're all over this area. Those are going to escape the hand of this person. Well, England took over all that area. And so they didn't escape England. But Napoleon took to stayed to the coast. So that to me, that's helpful. I won't say it resolves it, but it seems helpful to me. Julius Caesar also just took this area up here. Now, Rome later had power over more than that. But Julius Caesar himself just kept to the coast again. So Julius Caesar and Napoleon both seem to fit that reasonably well. Okay, now, in Daniel, the fourth chapter, I guess we should read a little more, because we didn't really read past the tree. So let's go to verse 15 in Daniel 4, 15 through 18. Yeah, 15 through 18, that'd be good. And let's see. Gracia, do you have that in front of you? Could you read that for us?
Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows it on whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men. This is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, tell me its interpretation, inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for a spirit of the holy gods is in you.
Hey, thank you. You know, Nebuchadnezzar appreciated what Daniel had already said. It's unfortunate Nebuchadnezzar said the spirit of the holy gods, plural. But I do wonder a little bit if this is the word Elohim. I don't know. If it is, it could be singular or plural, right? So maybe he's being more honorable than it sounds like here. I don't know. But it's interesting to me that in verse 17, the lesson is he even sets up over it the basest of men. Now, what I find interesting is that this is still Nebuchadnezzar's recounting of his dream? Is these Daniel's words or Nebuchadnezzar's words? Boy, that's interesting that he would recount that, set over at the basest of men. He's got to know that he's somehow involved here, but he says this. Now, Daniel is rather more cautious. In verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour. He was troubled in his thoughts. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation trouble you. And Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream be for them that hate you and the interpretation to your enemies. In other words, you're not going to like this. I think that's why Daniel was so troubled. You know, how am I going to tell him? This is for you, king. You're going to be abased. Your kingdom is going to be lost. 7 times you're going to pass over you. You're going to be like a wild animal. But it'll all turn out better later. Now, it's interesting to me that we started with the tree. And the tree had the bands of iron and brass. And here, that's kind of like Daniel chapter 2. You have the iron and the brass. But you all know that chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and chapter 7, Daniel's dream, are parallel. If I'd even have it right here. So there's the beast. The 7 times is going to see these beastly governments range over the world of mankind. So in the Daniel chapter 4, you've got both elements. Kind of that remind you of chapter 2 and chapter 7. And in chapter 7, these beasts that range the world are kind of like represented by Nebuchadnezzar's beastly condition. So I find this very interesting. Chapter 4 kind of brings in parts of 2 and 7, which we already know are telling us the same thing. So the tree and the beast are two ways of telling us the same thing. So this is interesting. Now, in verse 20, Daniel explains the whole thing. The tree that you saw, whose leaves were fair. Verse 22, it's you, O King, thou art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown, it reaches unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one say, cut down the tree and destroy it, leave the stump of the roots in the earth with a band of iron and brass, this is the interpretation, O King, they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, you'll eat grass as an ox, be wet with the dew of heaven till seven times pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. And then you're going to have your kingdom restored later. Verse 28, all this came upon Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace and thought, "Ooh, look at all the things I've done." And while the word was yet in the king's mouth, a word fell from heaven saying, "To thee it is spoken, thy kingdom is departed. They shall drive thee from men." Verse 33, the same hour was a thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar. And verse 34, at the end of the days, Nebuchadnezzar lifted up mine eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever and ever. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was a very interesting person. He had a certain nobility of character. Yeah, he was given to passion and anger, and, you know, I guess as a monarch, you got to be in control. He certainly was in control. He told the three Hebrews, you know, right to the furnace, you know, that's it for you. But boy, he was really humbled here. This is really remarkable. And, you know, this whole chapter, who was writing this chapter, chapter 4? It seems like an odd question in the book of Daniel. But who's actually writing this? Well, in verse 34, Nebuchadnezzar is writing this. Verse 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar, such and such. And he is telling everybody about this. He's writing this to his whole kingdom. He says, praise, honor, and extol the God of heaven. Boy, that head of gold, he really did praise, honor, and extol the God of heaven. And Cyrus honored him, and Alexander did okay, and Rome broke them. But this is rather remarkable for this heathen king. All this came upon him, and he says, okay, you know, yeah, it's not me. I'll be humbled. And I think this is a picture of how the world is going to recognize the same thing, and Israel as well. They'll recognize, okay, God broke us. You know, he gave us a wonderful thing to begin. He took it away from us because we were rebellious. He's given it back. All praise to God. He's right. He's right in everything he does. And we should be humbled. It's just a real nice lesson. Sister Jackie?
And he did become a real humble man. And at Daniel 4:30, just before he lost his mind, he was very haughty there. And Jehovah had to bring him. He said, Babylon the Great, that I myself have built for the royal house with the strength of my might and for the dignity of my majesty. So he did not recognize that he was being allowed to rule. And so since he was so boastful, Jehovah just chopped him down.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of Israel's that way too. You know, under Zedekiah, he said, just submit. But he wouldn't submit. He broke his oath and he just went his own way. And even to Josiah, God said, it's been so bad with Judah under Manasseh and so forth. The sins are so bad. Even though you're a good king, it's not going to stop the punishment coming. It's going to come one way or the other. So Israel really did bring it upon themselves. And they were haughty, and they were proud, and they were idolatrous. But in the end, they're going to be humbled, thankful, compassionate, and they're going to be used as a tool and an instrument to bless the world of mankind. Now, this seems just incredible. You know, I have a good friend of mine. His name is David, too, David Garrison. And probably the closest friend I ever had when I was a boy. We were friends before we even moved to the same neighborhood. That was interesting. And, you know, we talked about things now and then. But as we got older, and I would talk, you know, from time to time, I told him about the hope of Israel. And that just seemed the last thing he could imagine. Israel? You know, it just seems out of the blue. Israel's going to be used? You know, I just didn't have any thought of that they were worthy of anything. And it kind of struck me. I was a little surprised at that. But really, Israel doesn't deserve anything, but God graciously has given them sacred promises. And that's why he says in Romans 11th chapter, for the sake of the fathers, they are still elect. and they still have a position in God's plan. And that's very clear in Daniel, the fourth chapter. Okay, that's all I have to say about Daniel chapter 4. And if you want any additional comments or investigation, we'll have that now. Otherwise, we'll move on. Anything you want to say about Daniel chapter 4? Brother Dave?
You had asked about this word. Now I just lost it. This word, gods, and it comes. It seems like it would be more appropriate to have it singular.
Really?
Yeah. When you do look it up, now I have to re-look it up.
Is it the word Elohim or something else?
No, it's Eloah. Eloah. It corresponds to that word.
That was Daniel 4. What verse was that?
4:18.
4:18, and it's Eloah?
Yeah, I had it here in
E-L-A. Eloah. Interesting.
I decided to go away on me. The word is, it comes from Strong's 426, and it's really E-L-L, you know, it uses the word with L in it, which is, and then ah, L-ah.
Uh-huh.
And it and that's the Aramaic. It's an Aramaic word which corresponds to 433. And 433 is L-O-ah.
And the other word ahead up there, yeah.
Yeah, Eloah. And it's God. It just means God or false God. So, what's that? It is not mine. Mine shows that it's not plural. But
okay. Well, I'm going to look at that more carefully.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Does any translation that anybody has here show something that's singular there? Well, is she going for good? I didn't say goodbye? Okay. All right. Yes.
In the PC Study Bible, I can double-click on it. It'll give me all the semantics.
Mm-hmm.
Of the word. I'm not sure what word to use. Or the parts of the word. It'll tell me if it's an adjective, singular, masculine, feminine. It says it is indeed plural here, but it also depends on the manuscript.
I see. Yes.
It makes great sense for it to be plural here. This is before he's been humbled, that he said this to Daniel. After he's been humbled, then, can't find the verse now, but then he says it singular.
The God of heaven. He praised and extolled the God of heaven.
Yeah, so it was plural before he was humbled, and then singular after he's humbled.
Okay, very good, thank you. Somebody mentioned Aramaic. He said this is Aramaic. You know, the book of Daniel is different than many of the rest of the Old Testament. It's written in Aramaic rather than strict Hebrew. But is there any part of Daniel that's written actually in Hebrew? There's some part. Do you know which parts? Is that Hebrew? I actually don't know. Let's see. What chapter is that? That's chapter 5. I hadn't thought about that. Means,
but I think the rest of the
Yeah.
I think the rest of the chapter outside of those words.
Nice to see you.
Bye. I think the rest of the words in the. As I understand it, the Aramaic runs from like chapter 2 through 7 or 9 or something. There's like five to seven chapters in there. I don't remember exactly where it is, but it strikes me that it's in the middle of the book.
Yeah, I thought it was 2-7, but I don't know where it's at.
Well, I have a note here. Oh, see, 2-4. Yes. See, chapter 2, verse 4 starts the Aramaic. And then there's two verses that are in Hebrew. That's chapter 7:28 and chapter 8, verse 1. Those are in Hebrew. And I'm presuming, therefore, the remainder is in Aramaic. But I'm not real sure. I'll have to double check the facts on that.
The theological word book of the Old Testament says that this word Elah is the usual word for God in the Aramaic.
In Aramaic. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, that makes
sense.
It is
like the uncommon Hebrew Eloah. There's a similar Hebrew word, which is used largely in Job. It differs from the Hebrew in that there is no plural of majesty, in which the word God is plural, but construed as singular. The plural form simply means gods.
Okay, all right. Then we'll fall back on what Sister Sherelle says. After his humbling, he was more specific. Before his humbling. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that information. Yes.
I so graciously and humbly appreciate the dear time I spent with you.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, Sister
A labor
Jackie.
Of love, and may God bless you.
Thank you. We all want to wish her good Godspeed. God bless. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, now, so I'm going to pass away from Daniel chapter 4 now, unless there's any more comments on it. Okay, and one of the, you know, when we started this on the first day, I mentioned that Daniel 1:1 was sometimes challenged by the critics, that Daniel was taken in the third year of Jehoiakim. And we handled that and dealt with that. I was even surprised that's much of a criticism. But those texts really are legitimately correct. We talked about that. But one of the other things that critics have pointed to through the years is Darius the Mede. I said we might get back to that matter of who Darius the Mede is. And there is a book written in the 1930s or 40s that was very prolific about this that talked about all the reasons why the critics think that Daniel was an imposter. And one of them is the mention of Darius the Mede. Now, if Daniel claims to have been on the scene in Babylon when Babylon fell to the armies of the Medes and the Persians, and then it says Darius the Mede took the kingdom, who is this man called Darius the Mede? And by the way, when you get a little later and Belshazzar dies, who's this man named Belshazzar? These are two things that critics would bring up against the book of Daniel. Not both in the 1930s. By the 1930s, the latter one had been resolved. But we want to look now at Darius the Mede. I'll get back to Belshazzar. And find out who this man really is. Because if Daniel was a Jew, writing when he said he was writing, he was seeing what was going on, then when he said there was a Darius the Mede, he's got to be right. So who is this man that history doesn't seem to remember? He seems like a pretty important person because he received the kingdom. Now let's look at Daniel chapter 5, where he's first brought to the picture. You mentioned Meeni Meeni Tekel Upharsin, and we're going to go right to that area. Daniel chapter 5, verse 29, 30, and 31. And we'll have some more comments now about this Meeni Meeni Tekel Upharsin and Daniel and Belshazzar from the first couple of verses. Let's start with verse 16. Verse 16. Daniel 5, verse 16. And Brother John, could you read for us Daniel 5, 16? I think we need a microphone over there, too.
Daniel 5, verse 16.
Yes, please.
But I personally have heard about you that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom.
Third ruler in the kingdom. Now, read verse 30 as well, if you would. I think that's it's going to mention that again.
That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain.
Yeah, and the next verse, too.
So Darius the Mede
I'm sorry. The verse just before that. I need the verse just before.
Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom.
So twice it's mentioned he's the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, who is Daniel a picture of in the whole book, you know, generally?
The
church in the gospel age. So at the end of the kingdom of Babylon, Daniel, the church, is going to be exalted in rulership. Why is it the third position in the kingdom? God, Jesus, and then the church is next. Yes. Shira?
When we see how it pans out, he really isn't the third commissioner. He is one of three people that's put over the 100 and...
Okay, now you're talking about after
Darius takes over.
Yeah, that's right. But while Belshazzar still lived, that night, he said, "You're the third ruler." You know, Amenhotep's brief, you know. But that's the point. He got the third position in the kingdom. That's where the decree went out. Now, what else did he get besides that third position in the kingdom? A gold chain around his neck? What does that represent for the church?
Immortality.
That's the divine nature, the gold hopes that we have. And the scarlet, there's the robe of royalty. So I think it shows the church invested with royalty, have the divine treasures, and made third ruler in the kingdom. Well, this is all about the church. And this really, I think, supports Brother Frank Shalhoub's concept that Daniel does picture the church during the gospel age. But now, why literally would Belshazzar make him the third ruler in the kingdom? I mean, if you want to do something good and really good, why not make him next to the throne? You know, Joseph was next to the throne, right? Next to Pharaoh? Pharaoh said, "You're going to be next to me, number two man. Nobody higher than you in the whole kingdom other than me." What does Joseph, as number two man in the kingdom of Egypt, represent? Jesus. So Daniel, number three, represents the church. That all makes sense. But why did Belshazzar only offer him the third position? Now, maybe you say, well, to make a good picture. Okay, but literally, why did he? Yes.
Because his father had the first position, he had the second position, but he was set in charge while his father was away?
That's exactly right. That tells you who Belshazzar is. He's not the monarch on the throne. Now, Jackie is gone, but Jackie's the one that told us, yeah, Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus, who was the real man on the throne. I said we get back to Belshazzar later while we're doing it right now. There was a treatise written in 1920s, and it was written by a professor, Philip Dougherty of Yale University, and the name of the book was Nabonidus and Belshazzar. I hope I've got that correct. But I've got a copy of it at home. And he goes through all of the old records, and he says Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus, who was appointed in the third year of Nabonidus. Nabonidus ruled for 17 years. He was the last emperor of the Babylonian Empire. So Belshazzar was given the kingship while his father went out with other interests. He was an old statesman. He had other things to do with the rest of his life. So that explains Belshazzar, who this man was. Now, the critics used to bring that up also as a sign to impugn the integrity of the author of this book. And now, well, everybody knows who Belshazzar was. Well, doesn't that somehow vindicate Daniel to know that for centuries people lost sight of who this last king was, but Daniel always knew, and now that we have the old records again, now we can see, oh, he was very right. So this gives us some hope when we go to Darius the Mede. Now, in John, you read the last verse of chapter 5. Let's read that again. In fact, 30 and 31 again, those two, and that'll focus on Darius the Mede.
Starting in verse 30. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62.
Okay, so there's the first introduction to Darius the Mede. Now the big question is, who is this person? Who is Darius the Mede? And do you have some opinions about who you think he might have been? I do. That's true.
I don't remember where I found it when I was looking for more information on Cyrus, mm-hmm. but I believe it was Cyrus's uncle that stayed in Babylon while Cyrus was out conquering.
Okay, that is an opinion that is sometimes held in old literature. And sometimes, you know, old literature is the only thing we have on some of these questions. But that's really a view that really is not current with people that have researched it currently. But that's out there. So what other options are there? I've got two books at home, and they each give a different point of view. And one of them is called Darius the Mede by a man named John Whitcomb. John Whitcomb is a Christian believer. He's a scholar. And he says he thinks that Darius the Mede was a governor that was appointed by Cyrus over Babylon. Because everybody knows that Cyrus really was the king who took Babylon. That's not really a question historically. Do we have a scripture that tells us that? Do we have a scripture that tells us that it was Cyrus who broke Babylon? We do. We even read it today. What scripture is that?
Isaiah 45.
That's it. That tells us Cyrus was already the person in charge when they took Babylon and they broke it. And broke the gates of iron and the gates of brass and bars of iron and all that stuff. So we know that Cyrus was in control. It wasn't as though a Darius the Mede came in and then later Cyrus came to power. That is a thought you might read in some theological works of old vintage. It's simply not feasible. Cyrus was the king. How many years was Cyrus king before he conquered Babylon? I mean, king of Persia. Almost 30 years. Almost 30 years, or maybe 30 years. But a long time, that's the point. He wasn't a Johnny-come-lately. Now, Cyrus had actually conquered the king of the Medes, and his name was Astyages. Cyrus had conquered him, and he turned out to be his own grandfather, because Cyrus's mother was Median. She was the daughter of Astyages. Cyrus's father was Persian. He was the son of the previous king. And so he had actually conquered the Medes, and the Medes willingly accepted his authority. As a matter of fact, they kind of rebelled against Astyages. They didn't really like him that well, and they went over to Cyrus. And Cyrus has treated his grandfather with respect and kindness. This leads some people to wonder if maybe Astyages was Darius the Mede that Cyrus allowed to... But no, he is not. He was gone by that time, and that's not part of the picture. So was he then a governor appointed by Cyrus, Darius the Mede? Or there's one other point of view. But, Paul, you had a comment.
Are you going to Daniel 6:28?
Well, you go there and read that for us. That's a good place to go. Daniel 6:28.
So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. But some translations translate this, so Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, which is also the reign of Cyrus.
What translation says that?
Let's see if I can find it. It's from Wikipedia. Must be true then. And I have to find it. Let's see.
Well, I'll keep looking for that, because I want to find that.
Oh, here it is.
Okay.
So Daniel prospered could also be translated. So they don't give the translation.
Okay.
So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius. That is the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So furthermore, kings commonly took dual titles, and Nabonidus, Cyrus's cousin, referred to Cyrus as the king of the Medes.
Cyrus was called the king of the Medes. He was, because the Medes were the more famous kingdom. You remember we talked earlier in Daniel chapter 8 about the two horns, the Medes and the Persians, and the higher one was the Persians who came up later. First, the Medes were more prominent. So sometimes Cyrus was called the king of the Medes. And yet here, usually we think of him as king of the Persians. So there's that's what they called in Hebrew the letter, which becomes a word, wa. And let's see, I think it's the fourth letter of the alphabet. I hope I'm not misrepresenting that. Because my name in Hebrew, does anybody know what it is? Three letters. DVD. And in the Hebrew, that's letter number six. Let's see, I hope I got this right. That's letter number four. Letter number four. It's letter number six. Letter number six. Now sum up those numbers for me. What's the number of my name?
14.
That's the number of the name of King David. I'm just, you know, from King David, named after him. So do you remember in Matthew, where Matthew makes a point that from Abraham to King David was 14 generations. And then from King David to the captivity was 14 generations. And then from the captivity to Jesus, the son of David, was 14 generations. He makes a point of this. Not only that, he edits the generations to make sure it comes out 14. Now, he's got a reason for that, because after Athaliah infiltrated the kingdom in the south, there were three kings that came from her line. And then it was better after that. So you eliminate those three, you got 14 generations. But the point is, Matthew had a purpose of making 14 generations. And that's because he wanted to show that Jesus' genealogy showed him to be the heir of King David. Because King David was promised, you'll have the throne. So from Abraham, the original promise, to that throne of King David, 14. Then to captivity, 14. And then to Jesus, 14. His point is that that's the name of the name, the number of the name of David. That is his point. That's why he emphasizes that. We lose that because in our culture we don't do that kind of thing. That's why I remember that these are the right numbers. Now, I think that V is the WA. You spell out that letter, you know, as a word, it's WA. I hope I got this right. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, you know. But the point is, it's that can be the word and, or it can be the word even. Now, in the Greek language, there is another word, chi, that can be either the word and or even. So that's the issue here. Now, let me show you a place where this construction appears, where what Paul said, everybody agrees, is right. It's 1 Chronicles 5, 26. 1 Chronicles 5, 26. And I like that read from the King James and then from any modern version after that. Who's got King James? David. 1 Chronicles 5, 26. Now, this is not talking about Darius. It's talking about an entirely different king, Tiglath-Pileser. And it's going to give him a couple of names here. 1 Chronicles 5, 26 is just a record of something that happened in Israel long ago.
And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and I think that's the word you want to focus on,
Yeah. The
spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites, and do you want me to continue more on that?
No, that's fine. Yeah. Okay. You've got the part that I want. So that's King James. He stirred up the spirit of King Pul and Tiglath-Pileser. It's usually said Tiglath-Pileser, but in that version it's Tiglath-Pileser. So that makes it sound like two separate and distinct kings. Now, anybody with a modern translation, Randy?
New King James Version. Okay. So the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, that is Tiglath-Pileser, king of, that is, he uses the word that is, king of Assyria. He carried the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh into captivity. He took them to Hala, Habor.
Okay, that's fine. You got the part that we need here. And the point is that word is even. That can word mean either and or even. Now, the reason the modern translations put that is or even, you know, Tol, even, Tiglath-Pileser, is because today everybody knows that's the same guy. You see this little part of his name here? Pil? That's why his abbreviated name is Pul. Remember, there's no vowels. Pul, Pil, who's to say which it should be? And we know that because in the old records, it talks about this person and it calls him Pul, Pulu, actually, in another record. So today, everybody knows that wants to know. They know that this is the same guy. So the modern translations say, oh, that's Pul, even Tiglath-Pileser. That's the same construction as in Daniel 6:28. Now, there's a very well-known scholar. His name is Donald Wiseman, and he used to be formerly of the British Museum. He's older, and so he's retired. I think he might even be deceased now. But I wrote him a letter and asked him about this question, and he's famous for this view. I says, you know, I read this book by John Whitcomb, Darius the Mede, and I said, sounds pretty good. What do you think? You know, is this the right? He says, my good friend John Whitcomb and I have a different opinion. And he explained that his opinion, Donald Wiseman, is that Cyrus and Darius are the same person. And he explained this very point about the word wa could be even. And sure enough, that's 1 Chronicles 5:26 is just that construction. Donald Wiseman's view today is the standard view and understanding of this text. I now believe it's correct. When I wrote Time of Prophecy, I thought John Whitcomb was right. And now that I, when I wrote Stream of Time, I now realize that Donald Wiseman is right. It's got to be somebody in history. Now I think we know who it is. It's Cyrus. And so his name, according to the Medes, was Darius. And his name, according to the Persians, was Cyrus. Darius the Mede, Cyrus the Persian. He had a mother that was a Median, and he had a father that was a Persian. Now, there's more to the story than that, but we got some more here.
There's a comment online about the NIV having a footnote about Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus. The NIV actually states that in the footnote.
In Daniel chapter 6. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm glad to know that. I actually didn't know that. I knew that that was modern thinking, but I didn't actually know that that was actually in the footnote. I'm going to write that down. NIV footnote.
Yeah, it is in the NIV.
Do you happen to have that footnote right there with you? Oh, why don't you read that for us?
I'll read the passage.
Okay.
So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus, or Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus the Persian.
Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Okay, very good. Now, let me ask you about the ancestry. Who was that, by the way, that commented and contributed to that? Oh, thank you, Marilyn. Thank you. Appreciate that input very much. Now, we want to find the ancestry of Darius the Mede. Let's see. Now, where is this? It might be in chapter 9. Yeah, chapter 9, verse 1. This is the first year of Darius the Mede, of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. Yeah, let's read that verse. Daniel 9, verse 1. Estelle, do you have that in front of you?
In the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over Babylonian kingdom, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understand from the scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet, and the desolation of Jerusalem.
Okay, all right. That's more than we need.
All right.
Okay. In the first year of Darius, who was he the son of? Ahasuerus. Did I spell that right, or is that E-S? U-S. Okay, so we got Ahasuerus. Okay, so that's the father of Darius the Mede. Now, is there an Ahasuerus anywhere else in the Bible you know of?
And Esther.
Esther is going to be married to Ahasuerus. But we talked about Esther a little bit already, and we learned that Ahasuerus has another more common name that we use in history. Xerxes. Now, he's down the road. You know, down the line, he's some generations after Cyrus. There was Cyrus, his son Cambyses, a man named Pseudosmerdus after that, and then Darius Hysaspes for 36 years, and then Xerxes. So some writers have actually mixed this all up. And they said, well, that guy in Esther is the same as the father of Darius the Mede. Oh, it just totally tangles everything. You can look in the companion Bible and you can see this tangled mess. It's just unfortunate. Because 100 years ago, people didn't really know what was going on. They said, hey, let's rewrite history and make all this come out a certain way. Oh, it's just a tangled mess. No, that's not it. So, but why is this man called Ahasuerus? What was his real name that we would know him by? It must be somebody famous in order to say, well, you want to know who Darius was? Oh, he was the son of Ahasuerus. But we know that Cyrus was the son of the Persian king. So it's not Ahasuerus. So who is this guy? Well, the famous king of the Medes wasn't just Astyages who was conquered. The famous king of the Medes was a man named Cyaxares. Now, do you see any part of that that kind of looks like Xerxes? Xerxes. And so that is transliterated into the Hebrew as Ahasuerus. That was the famous king of the Medes. He was not the immediate father of Darius, who was Cyrus, but he was the ancestor through Darius's mother, of course. Darius's mother came from Cyaxares. Now, the person that explained this to me was a gentleman on one of these discussion groups. His name is Tory Thorpe. He's Jewish. Happens to be a black Jew, by the way. Extremely bright. Sometimes his words are a little bit sharp. People don't like to discuss with him too much. But he's the one that clarified that for me. I thought, well, this is duck soup then. Ahasuerus is Cyaxares. That's telling you. Everything makes sense now. Darius's mother was descended from Cyaxares. So they're trying to tell you this Darius the Mede has royal blood on both sides of his family. He is Cyrus the Persian. He's Darius from Cyaxares, the son of Ahasuerus. That's the resolution of that word Ahasuerus. And it helps straighten out all of ancient history too. So this critical question, who's Darius the Mede? Was he a fictional figure? Now I think we can put a period on. We know who he was. He was Cyrus. That's all. Now everything makes sense. So early on, when the Medes were more popular, sometimes somebody even mentioned, sometimes he was called Cyrus, the king of the Medes. Sometimes he was called Cyrus, the king of the Persians, because they were brought together. Sherelle?
Was there a political reason why Daniel would want to emphasize his Median ancestry?
There might have been, and in this I can only postulate and guess what might have been. But because the Medes were known so much as the stronger kingdom, in fact, the Medes actually helped overthrow Nineveh way back even before the Babylonian Empire. It was the Medes that were always known as the vibrant part of the partnership. Just like Daniel says, the higher horn came up later. That was the Persians. Because of that, historically, the Medes were just the more dignified, powerful entity. And so I think to recognize him as the king of the Medes, or Median, because he was half Median, is why this is put in there that way. But later, after Cyrus conquered the whole Babylonian Empire, and it was part of really his father was Persian, then it became known more and more as Persia, rather than Media, or even Medio-Persia. Okay, that's Darius the Mede. Any comments or questions? Who is Cyrus a picture of?
Right.
Jesus. So I think that Darius is kind of a picture of Jesus, you know, in that respect. Okay. Yes, Cheryl?
Are you looking for questions on any part of chapter 5 or only on this part?
No, anything you want. Anything you want.
I wasn't here the first night, so maybe you covered this and I wasn't here, so I missed it. Back in Daniel 5,
yes,
there were three things that were given to Daniel. Or you've got actually four things that are mentioned. Actually, more than four or five, I think. But you've got the gold chain. You've got scarlet robes. You've got the ruler position. You have the golden cup. And... Oh, excuse me, not clothes in scarlet. Clothes in purple is what it says in my version of the Bible. And I believe you have his harem there with him, too.
His what?
Concubines. Yeah, wives and concubines.
Whoa. Which verse are you talking about?
Belshazzar's wives and concubines drank from the golden cup.
Oh, okay, yes.
Then you go over to Revelation 17, and you've got a lot of the same symbols, not in the same order or... And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of correlation. You've got in verse 7, you have the woman clothed in purple and scarlet. She's adorned with gold and precious stones. So the golden necklace, she's got the golden on her too. She's got the gold cup, and she is a harlot. So it's not the same thing as a concubine, but it's still a woman who did not have the right to be drinking out of that cup.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there was any kind of similarity or if they just happened to be the same words with no connection.
Well, it's, just you bringing it to our attention sounds to me like a pretty good connection. I mean, here's a picture of Belshazzar at the end. That is the judgment of Babylon. Well, what does the woman have written on her forehead in Revelation 17?
Babylon the Great.
Babylon the Great. She's got the name of the same institution that's being judged here. Actually, I never observed those connections before. Now, those are very good. I want to put that down in my notes, too. What verse was that in Daniel 5?
4.
Daniel 5:4. Okay. I think that's a very good connection. I think that fits very nicely. Now, of course, the great harlot is going to be eaten up and burned by, by the dogs and burned with fire. That's a little bit later down the road. But the beginning of the judgment in 1914 on the whole system of Babylon and the church state, that started back here. You got all those things depicted in the picture here. So that's very good. I appreciate you mentioning that. Odalea, did you have something? Okay. So now we're going to... yes, Jeff Paul.
Going back to Cyrus again, just very briefly. It says, Cyrus, my anointed one, right?
Yes.
That would more translate to the Christ rather than to just Jesus by himself. And I'm wondering if the two pedigrees, you know, point to Christ in the church, you know, the Medo-Persia, and also the mystery behind the whole thing, mystery hid from ages and generation, Christ in you, the hope of glory. You know, I wonder if Cyrus is more accurately Christ and the church.
Well, that's a very interesting possibility, Paul. Like the Medes are the church and the Persian is Jesus. I don't know. That's very interesting. I want to think of that through and look at that. In Isaiah 45, I'm inclined to think it's just Jesus. But the fact that that Cyrus kind of combines two lineages, that's very interesting. You know, if the church is, the whole anointed class is made of two stocks of people, Jews and Gentiles. I wonder if there's some part to this. I don't know. That's very interesting, Paul. I appreciate that. I'm going to cogitate on that a little bit. Okay. Now, I should mention, by the way, with respect to Darius the Mede, I know some brethren are troubled by this point. Well, who's Darius the Mede? And they have a different opinion. And they seem to think that somehow that's related to some important point. It's not. Everybody knows that Cyrus took Babylon in 539. That's just true. And if somebody thinks that there was an interposer of Darius the Mede for 2 years, you ever hear 536 was the fall of Babylon or the decree of Cyrus, 536? Well, that's why it's in volume 2. And that's why brethren sometimes hold on to that. And they're a little confused and a little concerned. There's no reason for that. If you want to really understand why 536 was ever suggested, you know, it was just picked up from a history book. It was suggested because of this. Everybody knew that in 539, Babylon fell. And everybody knows that their years, regnal years, begin in the spring. So after October 539, the next spring would be 538. And that was year number one of somebody. And so if Darius the Mede was not Cyrus and he interposed, then the theory was that Darius the Mede independently reigned for 2 years. And therefore, the first year of Cyrus who followed him would be in 536. That's where it comes from. Today, nobody thinks that. There's no historical person that says you only find that in books, you know, more than 100 years ago or so, or things that are lingering from that. But there's no reason to attach to that. Suppose you want to really insist upon this point. You really do? Then you really think 536 is the first year of Cyrus? And you really think that was the decree to restore Israel? Well, here's the theory that goes with it. That means that you can add 70 years of desolation onto that and get 606. Now you take the Gentile times from there. Well, let's do that. Somebody tell me, if you take 606 B.C., you know where I'm going already. 1915. That takes you to 1915. And nobody thinks that's the Gentile times ended there. So it's like trying to hold on to this is trying to force something that gives you an answer you really don't want. There's no resolution. The only resolution is to understand the facts. And the facts are that was the first year of Cyrus. That's when they were returned. And the first times the Gentiles really started when Babylon crossed the Euphrates, began a four-year campaign of conquest from 607 to 603 when Daniel says, now you're the head of gold. Bring that down to our day, 1914 to 1918, First World War. You know that 1918 was looked at as a date of interest by Brother Russell? Say, well, wait a minute, he died 2 years before then. But you know, there's an article, The Harvest Not Yet Ended, 5950, famous article, everybody seems to know that one. And he in there, he says, you know, he's trying to figure out what's going to happen, what's going on. 1914's passed. We're in 1916. The war's going on. Well, okay, what? And he says, well, we noticed that in 73, Masada fell. The parallel date would be 1918. Who knows? You know, that's my words, you know, but that's his spirit. We'll just keep our eyes open. He passed from the scene. Was 1918 relevant?
Yeah.
I think so. It was the end of the First World War. It did parallel Masada fall, and it parallels Daniel 2:38. You are the head of gold, 603. You finished the conquest that began 4 years earlier in 607. Everything fits. So I think rather than wrapped up, you know, trying to worried about something, but there shouldn't be. There shouldn't be any worry about it. And you can't really resolve the issue until you really get the facts of history, and now you can resolve it. By the way, there's a mention that Ptolemy said it was 536. He did not. Ptolemy, like everybody else that knows about history, says it was 538. It was other people that took Ptolemy and then counted two more years from there that 536. So don't we're worried about the confusion. Just, it all works. And Darius the Mede was Cyrus. Okay, any other questions on anything about Daniel you want to talk about now? We have just a few more minutes, and we're kind of trailing off. And while you're thinking about any questions that might be coming, I will say this, that we have talked a lot about the prophetic parts of the book of Daniel and, you know, the prophecies and even the experiences that he went through. Now, there were six chapters of experiences that he went through before you get to the prophetic section, right? We talked about that the very first day. And we talked about the fact that those first three episodes are all about the dragon, the beast, and the two-horned false prophet. And then the next three are the end of the dragon, the end of the beast, and the end of the two-horned false prophet. That's a nice conceptual, you know, aggregate there. But what we didn't look at was all the, well, lessons of character and fidelity and faithfulness that Daniel and his three Hebrew friends went through. But you put yourself in the position that Daniel was in. How old do you think Daniel was when he was taken captive out of Israel and taken to Babylon?
Young.
It was young.
16 or 17.
16, 17? Okay. What's that?
Or younger.
Or younger, yeah.
I heard 12.
Have you heard 12? I've heard maybe 15. We can't put a hard figure on it. We don't know. But he was a young man. And, of course, he was a young man of bright promise. So were his three Hebrew companions. And that's the reason that they were taken, because there weren't many people gone captive at that time. As a matter of fact, now what year of Jehoiakim did he go captive in? Third year. Now, the big captivity, when Ezekiel and others went captive, was 8 years later, during the reign of Jehoiachin, after he reigned for 3 months. And then another captivity is Zedekiah. There were hardly any of them that went captive with Daniel. Just a few. Just took some of the bright young ones, you know. I mean, I look at the Whitbrock girls and I think, you know, if they were young men, they would have taken them. You know, it's people of promise here, you know. But so now we're going to train them. We're going to make them, you know, servants to the king, and he's taking the brightest and youngest of all the, you know, kingdoms, and he's going to use them. So that's what Daniel's all about. So you're taken away from your family, from your home, just a young man. I mean, younger than the Whitbrock girls. Now, Lizette, how old are you? 14. Okay, well, that's where 14, 15, 16, somewhere, that's where I think of Daniel. So imagine you're ripped from your family. You're taken with some friends, you know, you're taken away, and then they're going to feed you the king's meat. And at that age, you have enough integrity of heart to say, this isn't what I should be doing. And so you're in jeopardy. You're not back at home. You're in the Babylonian courts. You're a young person. And yet you and your three Hebrew friends say, we're not going to defile ourselves with the king's meat. Now, you know, there's two ways of taking a position according to conscience. You can say, I won't do it. And that's all. I mean, you can have conscience, but it's almost like, you need pride to back up that conscience. It's a little weak, you know. Daniel didn't do that. There was a person involved with this story whose life could be in peril if Daniel took this position. Who am I thinking about?
His own.
Well, okay. that certainly is true. But it was another person. You know, he had to think about somebody else.
The king's official.
If you look in Daniel chapter 1, there's a name for this man. Verse 11. And in fact, 10 and 11. Let's read. 10, in fact, 9, 10, 11. I like those three. The first one is real nice. 9, 10, and 11. Lizette, why don't you read those for us? If you have it. Yes.
Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.
Okay, that's good enough. So now in my version, King James says Melzar. Now in the margin says that means steward, so I don't know if it's a proper name or a title. But Melzar here says, "Hey, look, Daniel, I mean, he liked Daniel. I mean, who couldn't like this young man who was respectful and polite and dignified and with integrity? Who couldn't like these young Hebrew men?" And he says, "I like you. I want to help you. But, you know, my head's on the block here. I'm supposed to be taking care of you. And if you don't look good, I don't look good." And he says, "Head's on the line." Is that what you said? Forfeit my head, yeah. So if Daniel had said, "You know, thank you, Melzar, but I really don't care. I got a point of conscience. That's all there is to it." You know, that would not be a really good attitude. So Daniel says, "Well, I tell you what, just let's try it out for 10 days and see how it goes. You know, we don't want you in jeopardy." What a nice, pleasant arrangement, a nice way. And then God would take care of the issue, and he did, and he made the outcome turn out well. Well, you know, in our circumstances too, you know, there's all kinds of points of conscience within our fellowship, with the world, you know, all kinds of things we say, I've made a decision, it's based on conscience. Well, we have to be thoughtful about how our decision affects other people. And we should take that in consideration. Daniel was not going to eat that meat. I think that's true. He wasn't going to eat it. But he didn't take an obstreperous point of view about it. Just meekly, quietly explained his concern, and then he looked for a way that would make it well with everybody. That's a wonderful spirit. And so that's one lesson I take away from Daniel, just even as a young boy. The next lesson is in chapter 3, and that's with his three Hebrew companions. Now, Daniel's already exalted, and he asked for his friends to be exalted as well, and so they were. That was from Daniel chapter 2 when he interpreted the image. And now you get to chapter 3. Daniel's not in the picture. That's interesting to me. Where was Daniel when the three Hebrews were supposed to bow down to the image? What do you think about that? Where was Daniel? Daniel's not even mentioned here. I kind of think that Daniel might have been out away on some other service or mission for the king. You know, he's a responsible person. Maybe that's the point. But the three Hebrews were there without the protection of the person that really had the esteem of the king. And now they're thrust into this situation. And now verse 8. Let's start with verse 8. Giselle, can you read that for us? Starting with verse 8 and just read down a little bit. I might interrupt you in there.
At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of God, of gold. And that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace."
Okay. And they point out, you know, we just happen to observe there's certain Jews over there that didn't do this, and you should know about this. So they had enemies. These were Chaldeans. They probably had a little jealousy over these Hebrew young men that were being exalted. They say, "King, you know, notice what they're not doing." And so there they are on the spot. What are they going to do? And so verse 13, "Then Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded them to be brought before the king." Nebuchadnezzar said, "Is it true, Oh, you three people that I've favored because of Daniel? What are you doing to me? I mean, I'm the king, and I favored you, and you're just resisting this? Really, is this true? Boy, that's quite a spot to be in. And these are still three young men. And then verse 15, he gives them another chance. He says, look, I don't often do this. You know, I'm giving you one more chance. And then they said, verse 16, Giselle, would you read 16 for us?
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up.
Okay, that was their answer. It says, we don't know whether we're going to be delivered or not. All we know is we can't do this. So if we're thrown into the furnace of fire, we perish, we perish. But if God saves us, he'll save us. We don't know. But either way, we just can't do that. So Nebuchadnezzar took that as an affront to himself. And now it says, his form of his visage was changed toward them. He says, okay, well, that's it. I've given them every break. Throw them into the furnace of fire. And then they see that fourth one walking among them. And Nebuchadnezzar thinks, okay, well, this is beyond me. You know, and then he respects and he exalts them and everything turns out well. But boy, that's a real circumstance to be put in. So for us, of course, we want to always be faithful to conscience. And we don't want to violate anything with conscience. But we don't want to be proud and arrogant with respect to it. We just want to be calm, peaceful, and correct. Now, yes, go ahead, Jeff.
This kind of indirectly related, but there's a... if I remember right, it's been a while since I looked at this, but it's a statue or a monument, I think, called the Istanbul Prism of Nebuchadnezzar.
Hmm.
Familiar?
I'm not.
And on it, it's undated. I don't think they have a specific date when this thing was constructed, but on it is apparently a long list of people who were officials in the Babylonian Empire. And in column 3, line 12, we have Musalem Marduk, which would be apparently Babylonian for Meshach. In line 15, we have Ardi-Nabu, which is similar to Abednego. And in line 18, we have Hanunu, which is similar to Hananiah.
Whoa. Oh, that's interesting. I feel like I should have known about this. Maybe I read it somewhere, but I didn't. This was something about Istanbul?
The Istanbul Prism of Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay, you might get an email from me about this, and then and you can give me some references on it. Okay, that's interesting. I'm glad you contributed that. Okay, you know, these are historical episodes. Now, by the way, these are their Babylonian names. So that's what they put on there. Their real names are Azariah, Mishael, and something. But these are the Babylonian names. Stefan.
What I'm not sure about is this strikes me. The end of chapter 2, the king was just privy to almost a miracle that Daniel performed and recognized not just him but the other three as having access to a God that is higher than anything he's known up to that point.
Yeah.
Then chapter 3 comes around and it's almost as if we're dealing with a different character. That same God no longer even remembers what happened previously. And this heavily reminds me of the Jews and their captivity in Egypt and the way the king reacted to the miracles that were performed in front of him. And then the Jews are reacting to a miracle, but then almost a few verses later, they flagrantly deny God, almost as if nothing had happened in the past. So, do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, things can slip pretty quick, can't they? But you know, in our own experiences, we can see the same thing. You ever been through an experience that you might consider a mountaintop experience? You draw closer to the Lord, you realize His providence, His care, His direction, and then maybe a few days or a few weeks later, you fall into something that's quite wrong. And, you know, we have those up and down experiences, and I think it's just part of human conduct. We should keep our minds remembering the higher goals, the loftier positions, and the sacredness which withhold our consecration. But we don't always. So more than that, I don't have anything. Anybody, Sister Joyce?
I had a conversation with a brilliant individual in the summer at a conference in Washington, D.C. He happened to be Jewish, not particularly religious, but he said with great frustration, he goes, you know, everybody thinks history just started yesterday. And that's the same thing. When so many things could be avoided if we learned from the things that happened in the past to mankind. But, you know, pretty much that's how mankind is. They forget very quickly and think that their history just started.
Yeah. You know, with the traditional expression, those who don't learn by history are fated to repeat it. Yeah. Giselle?
I was just looking at the end of chapter 2. It's written, moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. And after you have the story of them being in the furnace, but at the end of chapter 3, it's written, then the king promoted them in the province of Babylon. So it seems like he promoted them in the province of Babylon before the event with the furnace, and after he put them again.
Sounds like he might have elevated them even higher than what he had originally. But I see your point. You're just going by the words that are there, you think, well, it sounds like the same thing. But I think that in Daniel 3 it reflects the fact that he remembered these people. He knew them because he's given them a second chance. You know, I think he likes them, but when they refused, you know, they said, okay, now that's too bad, that's curtains. But now it looks like he even promotes them, I would infer from this, higher than before.
Brother David?
Yes.
New American Standard, I think, reads a little different from what she read. It says, then in the second verse that you read, it says, then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So it's not like he reappointed them necessarily to the same position, but whatever they were doing before, it would increase. So.
Okay, all right. Well, maybe that's a better way to resolve the apparent problem. Okay, thank you. I see now that Brother Jeff says that. I see in my margin it says Chaldean or caused to prosper. So maybe that's the point. Yes, Sherelle?
Also in verse 12 of chapter 3, it already says that they had been appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon. And then they're caused to prosper in verse 30, the same chapter. But I had another lesson that, if I may bring out, I really appreciate it.
Well, hold on now. You're talking about 3:12?
Yeah. That says that they're already in the administration, and then 3:30 says that they're caused to prosper.
Okay, I see. So that intensifies the concern that Sister Giselle brought out, and that maybe suggests Jeff's resolution is right. Okay, thank you.
There was another lesson that I loved that I got from Brother David Stein.
Yeah.
And it's back in Josiah. You know, Josiah was a good king, and yet all his sons were very evil kings. It appeared that he had no good descendants that came from him. And yet when we get to Daniel 1:3, it says the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles. In verse 6, it says, among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So there is thought in some of the commentaries that Daniel was of the royal family, that he was of the seed of Josiah, though not a son, and therefore that God had showed his righteousness or his faithfulness unto children's children.
Thank you. What verse are you pointing to in your comment?
1:3 and 1:6.
Okay, 1:3 and 1:6. Yeah, of the king's seed. Yeah, that's very interesting. So they actually were kind of royalty somewhere in the network of the royal family. That makes sense, because when you're going to take just a few prisoners, why are you taking a few prisoners? Well, of course, they were bright young men, of course, but in addition, you take them like hostages. to make sure of the fealty of those that you've left behind. And they wouldn't be adequate hostages if they weren't blood linked to you. It's like Epiphanes, you know, and yeah. Is that what you're going to remind? Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. So there was some good that came out of him. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Now, the other lesson that I would like to focus on just a little bit is in chapter 6. Of course, that's the famous one, you know, Daniel in the lion's den. And I love this picture, so I'll go back to that. There's Daniel, you know, intent to pray 3 times a day. And you know the story. There was a decree by Darius. Who's Darius? Cyrus. And so, you know, Cyrus is a noble kind of person. But they came to him with flattery and says, you know, we think it'd be a good idea, old noble Cyrus, if everybody made a crest of the gods through you or in your name or something nice. Like it has a nice ring to it. Okay. So he says, okay, let's do this. And the law of the Medes and the Persians, you can't cancel. But it was all a setup just to get at this dear man. Sure.
I was just thinking that they said that all of the governors, in addition to the satraps and commissioners, so he would not know that Daniel was not among the ones recommending this.
Yeah, they misrepresented it, didn't they? I mean, the chief of all of them was actually a target, not a party to it. But you know, Daniel had choices, and we would have a choice in that situation. I'm not sure how I would have done it. One choice would be to say, okay, well, I'm going to remain faithful. I'm still going to pray to God. I don't have to open my window and make a public display, but I'm still going to do it. But Daniel was accustomed to doing it that way. And so in his mind, he says, no, this is a matter of conscience. If I'm going to obscure my normal practice for the sake of this edict, that means I'm doing this because I'm afraid for myself, and I'm kind of giving in to a point of conscience here. So Daniel decided, no, I'm going to continue the same way. He was an elderly man by this time, 80s, 90s, I don't know. He only lived a couple more years, apparently. And he just chose this way. Now, God clearly approved of what his choice. But our choice might be different at different times. How you stand for your conscience isn't always prescribed. It's a matter of evaluation in the situation before you and what you think is appropriate and necessary to stand for your faith. But I suppose, you know, when Hitler was arranging, the madman, and a lot of brethren died under him, as I understand. I know some brethren in particular who died in prison camps, because I've heard specific stories, but I think a large number. I mean, as the way I hear it, after the war, the numbers of the Bible students were somewhat depleted. 75%. 75%. Wow. So, there's a lot of moments there for conscience. Now, I don't think it's going to happen that way in the future. Some brethren do. I don't. But whatever it is, there's going to be difficult experiences in the future, and even in the experiences we have now. We face situations at work or other places, situations of conscience, where we don't want to be offensive, but we do want to represent our conscience properly. I'll give you one little example. This is a nothing kind of example, but it's something that I remember when I had to go back to work for a few years, and I was involved with some of the managers of the business. And there was a gentleman that was the head of the salesman. His name was Bob. Pleasant gentleman, very pleasant. But he wasn't the kind of a moral person that, you know, we'd like to associate with. And when he told a joke, you could usually think it was, you know, not something you want to listen to. So he came out once, and all the people assembled there, and I was in the office area there at the time, and says, listen to this, something I got to say. And I thought, I'm not sure this is going to turn out well. So I kind of turned back to my desk, you know, and not impolitely. He looked at me and says, no, Dave, you can listen to this one. That's interesting. You know, he caught the idea, you know. So I turned around, gave him a smile, and listened. But, you know, what you do and how you conduct yourself, it's a testimony, and people know one way or the other. So, but of course, that wasn't any threatening situation at all. What he went through was threatening. That meant his life. And when he went down into the lion's den, he didn't know either, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't know how it's going to turn out. But he did. Now, you all remember Brother, some of you remember Brother Robert Sclemian?
I remember those.
You do? Okay. You remember the same thing I'm thinking about then. He was a poetic. Now, some of the younger ones, do you know the name Robert Sclemian? Okay, but you never knew him personally. He was in the Eastern Midwest. He moved to California, so I knew him growing up as a boy. And Brethren just generally loved his talks. He read his talks, but they were like stories. And it was just lovely to listen to. There's a whole, they're in print now, aren't they? Some of them, yeah. And I remember listening in firsthand to his story about Daniel in the lion's den and how he probably put his head on the soft belly of one lion and cuddled and purred by the other. Something, yeah. That was very nice, you know. But you know, in the situation, you know, who knows how things really were? I guess, I see, this isn't going to turn out so well. You know, the Christians were thrown to the lions. That didn't turn out so well for them. But you know what it says? Be thou faithful even to the point of death. That's Revelation 2:10. Now, when we're studying Revelation recently, we went through that, and other people have other than the King James. And when they read that translation, I thought, oh, okay, that gives me a new insight. I always had it. Be thou faithful unto death. You receive a crown of life. That's very good. But when you say, be faithful even to the point of death, now you get the episode. This is the second phase of the church. This is Smyrna. They're being thrown to the lions. They're being told, all you have to do is take a little salt, put it in the fire as a tribute to the God. That's it. We won't require anything more of you. Can you do that for us? It means your life. How many Christians did that? Some did. As a matter of fact, after 313, when things got better, you know, some of the Christian community didn't really want to receive back into fellowship some of the Christians that had done that. I mean, if that test was upon all of us, I would say some of the brethren might do this, some might do that. And it can be a test. It's for each one. That's where conscience really comes from, each individual and each experience. You want to use wisdom, discretion, but you want to be faithful. But others were more merciful and said, no, they, you know, this morning of weakness, let them back in. There was one very famous person, faithful martyr, famous martyr. He was a disciple of John. Polycarp. Do you know how he died? He was put to the test, basically. Are you going to do something to tribute to the gods, or are you not? And you know, he's an old man by that time. He lived a ripe old age. And he thought about doing this or that, and he says, you know, my Lord has never failed me. He's always treated me well and done everything good for me. How can I deny him at this point? And so he says, pleasantly, but thoughtfully and consciously, I cannot. And so they put him on, so what was it? They put him on the pyre. He was going to be burned. And they lit the fire, and then they threw a sword down on him, and the blood spurted out and put out the fire. So he was dead by this time. But they lit it again, and he was burned. But it's a very famous martyrdom. If you ever read about the martyrdom of Polycarp, it's kind of a classic. But there was a disciple of John who said, no, I've got to take the stand the right way. And a lot of Christians met their end that way, even to the point of death. Now, I don't know how the church is going to be taken. I think it's going to be taken, you know, with the Elijah going up into glory. They're going to be taken. I don't think they're going to die out naturally. How are they going to be taken? I really don't know. Some brethren think it's an ignominious way. I'm not sure that it is, but in some way the church is going to be taken. But there will be difficult experiences coming. If we're right about 14 years of storm, there's going to be stormy tribulation experiences. Just what sort they are, I don't know. But in every experience of life, we have to be like Daniel and thoughtfully, without ostentatiousness, humbly stand for what's right. There was a hand, I think. Jeff.
Well, you mentioned Polycarp. I thought it was, there's actually somewhat of a connection to Daniel here, because supposedly when, and this is tradition, nobody knows if this is actually true, but I really found the story kind of touching, is that when they finally caught up to him, he was in a house somewhere, and they caught up to him, and of course the house, it was apparently like divided up by curtains or something, you know, they didn't have like solid walls, and the story goes that Polycarp asked before he would be taken away by the Romans if he could have time to pray, and supposedly, and I'm just thinking of Daniel and the lion's den kind of thing, and supposedly his prayer, you could hear him, they could hear him pray, and his prayer was he went to every single person he knew and prayed for them. It was like not a personal prayer, it was just a selfishness of the concept struck me that he prayed for everybody else, and then he said, okay, I'm done. We can go.
Yeah, very nice. I didn't know that. That's a very nice touch for that. Sister Sherelle?
Just in connection with that, there was two stories I remember from my Christian history class I took. One was the story of Perpetua and her handmaid, who Perpetua had a small toddler, I think it was, maybe an infant, and the handmaid actually gave birth in prison awaiting to go to the lions. But they stripped the girls and they sent them to the lions, and the people in the stands were so disgusted they even turned away. They couldn't see the young girls who were so young. But then the other one was they said that at one point they stopped finding it effective to throw them to the lions because people were actually not even Christians, were joining the ranks of those that were going to be thrown to the lions because they didn't know what they had. But if it was so important that they were willing to give their lives for it, then it must be something of great value. And they wanted to be included in that great value.
Wow, what a testimony. What a testimony. So Daniel is a real example to us. It was the expression, dare to be a Daniel, dare to have a cause, dare to make it known. Yeah. So with that, we thank you. Thank you. I want to personally thank you for the opportunity of this. Now, Sister Marvie is gone. But yesterday I remembered something her father said that I'll never forget from the West Coast. His name was Alonzo Jarman, and he was in the L.A. area, and he was asked to give a talk to the brethren. And I remember how he started. He said, the honor of the occasion is not lost upon the speaker. That was a very humble way to start. Well, thank you for this privilege. To come here and speak to you about one of my favorite subjects, I can't think of anything I'd rather do. And to have so many people willing to listen so long while I talk about my favorite things, it's a pleasure. Thank you.